Welcome to the Quickening Report. Patrick Wood here, your host for today. Last week, we did a lot of coverage on these sustainable development goals that the United Nations has produced. And every time I get done with one, I think that's probably going to be it. But then there's a little bit more that comes along and you just have to keep going with it. So we've had about, I think, three or four parts now on sustainable development. And there's just one last thing that I really want to cover that kind of brings us up to date where we are today. I can't promise this will be the end of it, but this is important because the Sustainable Development Goals dates back to 1992 when at first they were given to or produced by the Agenda 21 conference. So sustainable development is an old doctrine. And it was produced, as we know, I'm going to show you here in just a second, remind you actually, that it was produced by the consortium of the Trilateral Commission. And I'm just going to take a look at this here and show you again that the two books that were principal in creating the Sustainable Development Doctrine. One was written by it's called Our Common Future, written by primarily Gru Harlan Brundtland and Jim McNeil. McNeil was not a member of the Trilateral Commission, by the way, but this book that he wrote that talked about beyond interdependence, this book was actually published by the Trilateral Commission. Their name appears on it on the inside cover. And Brundtland herself was actually a member of the Trilateral Commission. And she wrote this this book, and the United Nations later said that she's like the mother of sustainable development, and McNeil is like the father of sustainable development. McNeil was from Canada, by the way. And perhaps that's one reason that he didn't make it into the membership of the Trilateral Commission, but he was highly revered by the Trilateral Commission, as evidenced by the fact that they published his book. So the entire doctrine was created by the Trilateral Commission in the first place. And I know I've said this several times, but this is so important to understand. This is foundational. The whole idea of the new international economic world from day one was to grab the resources of the world, pure and simple. There really isn't any more complexity to it. Now, there is complexity with sustainable development today because it's got so many twists and turns, it's just amazing. But the original goal was to grab the resources of the world and put them into essentially a global common trust that could only be accessed by those people that are at the top of the, you know, manufacturing world, like members of the World Economic Forum. So everything that we're looking at today is just part of that con. I know it's kind of hard to look backwards and forwards at the same time on this, but this is exactly what has happened. And what we have today with that we're dealing with the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, these were actually created in 2015, which was 15 years after the year 2000. In the year 2000, the Millennium Goals, Development Goals, were created, MDGs, and there was only a few of them, but none of them got met. By the time 2015 rolled around and they kind of sunsetted, none of them had been met, and so the expansion of the effort was rolled out with these 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and we've covered all of these now, by the way, last week. If you're just tuning into this episode for the first time, and you said, what's he talking about? He said, well, go back and listen to the last few episodes. They're clearly marked. Sustainable Development Goals, I think it was part one and part two, and then there was a part three. Go back and listen to them and you can pick up on it. You can learn it pretty quickly. So we look at these development goals. We see number one, for instance, no poverty. Number two, zero hunger. Number three, good health and well-being. Number four, quality education. Number six, clean water. Number seven, affordable and clean energy. Doesn't this sound like utopia? It sure does to me. Well, everybody that ever wrote about technocracy in the last century, especially back in the 1940s and 50s, they called technocracy a utopian system. I didn't say that. I wasn't there to write that back then, but they called it a utopian-like system. And if you go back and read Aldous Huxley's book, Brave New World, it was written in 1932, the same year that technocracy was being formed at Clemson University. That also was a utopia that he was describing, that he was writing about, Brave New World. So this whole promise of these grandiose things is just a description of utopia. Like, here we go, world. We're going towards utopia. We're going to have this wonderful, wonderful world where there's going to be nobody's going to be living in poverty. Everybody's going to have a decent job. Everybody's going to have food to eat. They won't be hungry. They won't be starving to death. Everybody's going to be healthy. That's number three, good health and well-being. Everybody's going to be healthy because we're going to take care of them. Well, utopia has never been achieved in the world to date, and it's not going to be achieved now. But this is what makes sustainable development appealing, is this promise of utopia. Now, this is the con. This is where the con of this whole thing comes in. A resource grab that started out in the early 70s, just get a hold of all the major resources in the world, whether they be forest or mines or oil or any farming, any food, anything else that comes off the land. Grab the resources directly. Then it doesn't matter what system of money you have on top of it. As long as you have control over the resources, you can charge whatever you want in any possible currency or whatever might be in the system at the time. You can call the shots because you have the resources. This is just like neo-feudalism from the Dark Ages, really. The landowners, the land barons owned everything, and the poor people had to just kind of eke out a living on that land where they didn't own anything, but they had to give up a large percentage of their produce to the land baron. It wasn't a very good way of life. There was a reason they called it the Dark Ages, by the way. That was it. There was no hope of escape from that kind of a system. There was no hope of accumulating wealth because you couldn't own property. And you just had to eke out a living as best you could and hope that the land baron didn't kick you off of this land, if that's where you happen to be farming or raising some livestock or whatever. So we have all these red herrings put out to make people think this is such a good thing. We're pulling for utopia. We're going to do it this time. This time it's different, they'll say. Well, it isn't really different, right? So they think it is, but it's not. So if we keep that simplistic view of sustainable development, it'll be a lot easier to understand anything that comes along. This is just part of the con. You have to make people want to come into it voluntarily. You can't drive them into it like cattle or whatever, sheep. You have to lead them into it. You have to sucker them into it. And many of them have come. Now, there's skeptics like me and hopefully like you that will see through it and say, no, this whole thing is just a sham. It's a con game. And the end of it is going to be very ugly, as people will find out. Because when we do not have the right to own property, when we do not have the right to accumulate wealth, to pass on to our children, grandchildren, basically the great American experiment has come to an end. That's really what made America great, when you look back, is our economic ability to do things, to build, to create, to have new ideas and stuff like that. Well, that'll all be gone if this whole system goes the way they say it's going to go. But the details are in the fine print. Again, I'll say that. The details are in the fine print. The only thing you have to do to get this nirvana started, this utopia started, is give them control over all the resources. That's all. That's all they say. Just give us the resources. We'll tell you what you can consume. In fact, we'll tell you what you must consume. And then we'll tell you what you can make, too. And if you don't like it, that's tough. But we're going to build, in their mind, we're going to build a sustainable world, they say, where we're going to balance the resources of the world against demand and against the population in the world. And we're going to have responsible consumption and responsible and sustainable consumption and production, where they call the shots, not us. They call the shots on what is responsible. So if you want to just give up all the resources of the world to these people and say, hey, you know, let them deal with it. I'm tired of dealing with it anyway. So let them deal with it. They'll do good. How can they do any worse? You'll find out how much worse it can get in the future. So having said that, in any case, I want to go back and review one more document and refer you to it. And that's this document here. It's called the Sustainable Development Goals Report of 2022. That was just last year. And this is an update from 2015 when the SDGs were created, the 17 SDGs. This is like an interim update that they decided to create on the heels of the pandemic. And when the pandemic hit originally, remember that the World Economic Forum, as well as the United Nations, said that the pandemic represents the greatest opportunity to move into the Great Reset era, that is, the destruction of capitalism and free market economics, and move into that Great Reset area where the world will be converted into a sustainable development system. And that's technocracy. That's what it was in the 1930s, exactly. So they viewed the pandemic as the opportunity to spring the trap. And they're still working on it because it hasn't exactly totally sprung the trap at this point. But what we find out in this report, in any case, I'll make it a little bit bigger so that we can see the whole thing. The Sustainable Development Goals Report. As we look at this report, and this is a large, I think it's a 68-page PDF file, by the way. You'll notice over on the right side where we have all the color wheel here, these are the colors of the 17 development goals. You remember I said they always look pretty. It always looks like something that you just want to, man, that is really cool. I want to be a part of that. It's very psychological. But the table of contents here shows all the 17 goals with their respective colors and the page number associated, of course, table of contents, where they have written a summary, like an updated summary of where we are with that particular goal at today, in 2022. This is important because we see some common things in here. I had to read through this whole thing. I wouldn't recommend that you do it necessarily, but I read through it and I highlighted a few things that were interesting to me. And this kind of underscores the point. In the foreword, they write, as the world faces cascading and interlinked global crises and conflicts, the aspirations set out in the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development are in jeopardy. With the COVID-19 pandemic in its third year, that's probably not really true as it's pretty much gone at this point, the war in Ukraine is exacerbating food, energy, humanitarian, and refugee crises, all against the background of a full-fledged climate emergency. Using current data, the Sustainable Development Goals Report 2022 provides evidence of the destructive impacts of these crises on the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals. Now, their complaint, as we'll see, is that we're having an existential crisis in all these things. We're sitting on the edge of a major climate crisis. We're sitting on the edge of financial crises, a food crisis, energy crises, etc. And the world is basically going to fall apart. Now, this sounds a little bit like Al Gore to me when he said that the world is going to, you know, be over like in 12 years. The seas are going to rise and the polar ice caps are going to melt and the polar bears are going to die. This sounds kind of like this panic mode here. But it's absolutely persistent through this whole thing. I highlighted down here, against this backdrop, the world is enduring the highest number of conflicts since the creation of the United Nations. Yes, there are a lot of conflicts right now, many of which I'm not sure these people didn't actually create, But again, alarmism is at the top of this here. This one at the top says, these solutions will only deteriorate with climate change, which acts as a crisis multiplier. Now, you probably didn't ever think of that this way. They do. A crisis multiplier. In other words, climate change lurking in the shadows, whatever other crisis might come up, climate change is a force or a crisis multiplier. It makes it worse by multiple factors, not just by a little bit, 10%, 20%, but by a whole lot. And then it says, and whose impacts are already being felt across the globe. Increased heat waves, droughts, and floods are affecting billions of people worldwide, contributing further to the poverty, hunger, and instability. Lastly, in the last paragraph, to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic and deliver global sustainability, we need an urgent rescue effort for the SDGs. So they say the SDGs are in jeopardy and they need an emergency rescue effort. Well, this foreword was written by the Secretary General of the United Nations. The next little section is written by, I can't pronounce his name down here, but it's written by the Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs. And he underscores basically the same stuff. He says, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development is in grave jeopardy due to multiple cascading and intersecting crises. Then he lists some of them. COVID-19, climate change, and conflict predominate. Each of them and their complex interactions impact all of the goals, creating spin-off crises in food and nutrition, health and education, the environment, and peace and security. To put the world on track to sustainability will require concerted action on a global scale. So he's saying the same thing that the Secretary General said. He goes on, to avoid the worst effects of climate change, as set out in the Paris Agreement, global greenhouse gas emissions will need to peak before 2025, that's just 2 years from now, and then decline by 43% by 2030, that's only 5 years later, falling to net zero by 2050. Instead, under current voluntary national commitments to climate action, greenhouse gas emissions will rise by nearly 14% by 2030. Well, that's quite a reversal. They said it was going to be all on target originally, and now we find out, no, they're actually going to rise. But of course, we need to remember, too, that the greenhouse gas emissions, so-called, that they blame on man's effort, man's irresponsibility, that whole body of thought and doctrine is just pretty nonsensical in the first place. But this is part of the con. This is part of the fear factor to drive people towards sustainable development. Meanwhile, he writes, existing evidence suggests that domestic violence has been exacerbated by the pandemic. Well, now we find out, this is just a little gotcha slipped in here. Everything else is being blamed on global warming and the pandemic and et cetera. And we know now Nirvana and Utopia are in jeopardy. And then he writes, oh, by the way, evidence suggests that domestic violence has been exacerbated by the pandemic and all this other stuff. Domestic violence. Well, that's a long ways from global warming and the world's going to burn up down to domestic violence. So who's being violent in a domestic violent case? Is it the men that go nuts or is it the women that go nuts? Or do they all go nuts together and just get in big Donnybrooks? See, it's not specified. But this is very, very thin, very thin as far as I'm concerned. He goes on to write, second, we must adopt low-carbon, resilient, and inclusive development pathways that will reduce carbon emissions, conserve natural resources, transform our food systems, create better jobs, and advance the transition to a greener, more inclusive, and just economy. He concludes at the bottom of this third, nothing short of a comprehensive transformation of the international financial and debt architecture will be required to accomplish these aims and to avoid a two-track recovery with developing countries left behind. Well, I suppose we can shed a tear for developing countries as opposed to where we are in developed countries. They have a hard road. And the reason they have a hard road is because most of them have no property rights in the first place. The people are not allowed to own property, call it their own, develop their own creative resources and products or whatever on their property, and accumulate wealth. They're stuck in a cycle of poverty. And, you know, they're shedding a tear for all these people. These are the ones that are always held up as being the victims. But notice that he's talking about transforming our food systems. Now, we've talked about this already a couple of times. They feel it's necessary, and their argument is that agriculture produces like 30% of the greenhouse gases in the world. They think that they need to take over agriculture and reduce that to get it down to net zero. And by 2050, so they're recommending to the world, the United Nations is, cut back on nitrogen-based fertilizers, for instance, and force farmers to be more creative in how they grow their crops. Well, that's, of course, impossible. Tell that to the farmers in the Netherlands, for instance, who are now absolutely rioting throughout the country, using their tractors primarily as blockades and just creating, you know, trying to create as much turmoil as they can for the government. The government apparently is not going to give in, and the farmers realize they're dead. They're gone. If they don't reverse this war on fertilizer, they are out of business, period, end of subject. They will be gone. And the government knows that. And the government's already said they're going to basically use eminent domain to force the farmers to sell. Like 3,000 farmers are going to be selling their farms in a forced manner to the government. So their careers, their whole life is at stake right now. So the other thing that's interesting here, too, is he talks about a financial crisis. Now, we happen to know, if you're watching the news, that we're currently in a financial crisis right now. The second largest bank failure in U.S. history has just occurred in Silicon Valley. It's a Silicon Valley, one of the largest banks in Silicon Valley, that serves startup companies and, you know, larger companies as well. But it has now gone into receivership. A second bank has also gone into receivership. And the ripples are spreading around the world like crazy. There is right now an international financial and debt crisis going on. Where it ends, we simply do not know yet. But as these crises unfold, there's going to be some surprises. Some of the surprises, for instance, companies that had their money with this bank had to make payroll. And all of a sudden, maybe they had their cash reserves of $2 million in the bank, and they were drawing their payroll out of that bank account to pay all their employees and stuff. Well, that money's not there right now. The government may give it back to them, but that money's not there. So when they go to make payroll, guess what? Nobody can get a payroll check. Well, that's a lot of people. And what are they going to do? Well, they're going to potentially have to default on some of their own debt. If they can't make their own payments, they're going to have to give up something, either turn it in or just, you know, let it be repossessed or whatever. So this is going to have ripple effects throughout the world, I'm afraid. So we do have an international financial crisis right now. And he talks about this will be required to accomplish these aims. Well, what aims again? Well, it's the Sustainable Development Goals. That's the only thing they ever talk about, is that whatever the crisis is, the answer is always sustainable development, and that's all. Down a little bit further into this document, we read, what are needed now are further investments in data and information infrastructure, drawing from lessons learned during the pandemic. The objective is to get ahead of the crises so that we can trigger more timely responses, anticipate future needs, and design the urgent actions needed to realize the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. That's it. Now, what's interesting here is that they're talking about data. They say part of the reason for the failure of all of these things is that they don't have enough data. So throughout this report, in virtually every one of the 17 explanations they're going to give in this report, it all talks about increased data collection, increased statistical analysis. This is the hallmark of technocracy, by the way. You know that, I've mentioned that several times, that technocrats crave data. They can never have enough data. And when something goes wrong, the first knee-jerk response is, well, we didn't have enough data. We couldn't, you know, head off the mistake or the error or the catastrophe, whatever, because we simply didn't have enough data. So we can fix that. In the future, let's make sure that we get more data. And so you see this throughout this report, more data, more data, more data, more data. And if you go through this, you will see this. Look at this headline, subhead. COVID-19 made clear the need for a strong statistical foundation, data. Look at this. The crisis helped to shape the future of innovation. COVID-19 crisis has been an extraordinary challenge for national statistical systems. It has also been an opportunity to experiment with innovative data collection methods, explore new data sources, and modernize ICT infrastructures to meet data demands for policymaking. And it just goes on and on and on. Here's another tell. Subhead, the pandemic was a reminder to leave no one behind. We see this all over their literature. They can't stand outliers. And lastly, NSOs need to strengthen coordinations within national data ecosystems. Data, data, data. This whole program is run by technocrats. That's all there is to it. It's technocrats doing their thing that they do best. And in the meantime, remember, it's a land grab of epic proportions. And that's exactly what they intend to do, is grab all the resources of the world. Well, that may be the last we talk about sustainable development for a while. It's a lot to absorb, I realize. But just remember how simple it is in the end. It's a land grab. All the rest of it is just the shell around the nut. I'm Patrick Wood for the Quickening Report. Thank you for listening today, and I hope you can really absorb everything we've been talking about. In the meantime, see you next time. God bless.